such, it was large enough for the military cot, small table and chair that had been brought in as his personal furniture. It wasn't much of a room, but it was better than most of the Jedi here received. He rose, tossing his blanket aside, and took down his robes from the hangar. Dressed, he moved out into his father's living room. It was still and dark, and Ben assumed at first that he was the only occupant. Then he saw his father, sitting cross-legged before the big viewport, staring, as was so often his custom, at the trees of Endor. Ben watched his father for a minute. He tried to make his voice calm, mature.
"I did my homework, you know."
Luke turned toward him.
"You sent Valen Horn off on a mission."
"Yes, I did."
"Would you send me off on a mission, where I might be killed?"
"You've been on missions like that. Centerpoint."
"Yeah, with Jason. You were actually sending Jason, not me. Would you send me, as a Jedi Knight?"
"When you're a Jedi Knight. You've only just been appointed as my apprentice." Ben took a deep breath.
"If you could kill Jason or save Valen from going to the dark side, which would you choose?"
Luke didn't answer. Ben fell silent. If he started talking again, his father could ignore the question, but Ben very much wanted to hear the answer. "Ben, I would kill Jason."
"So you gave me special consideration you wouldn't give Valen?"
"Yes." Luke lowered his gaze to his hands, which rested in his lap. "Speaking as the Grand Master, I shouldn't have."
"It makes me..."
Ben choked up and stopped.
"It makes me partly to blame that he's still out there."
"No, it doesn't."
"Yes, it does. And I'm not saying anything except I don't want any special treatment. Not anymore. Not when there's anything important riding on it."
Luke nodded. "You're right." He gave Ben a sidelong look. "You realize what a concession that is for me to give. How hard it is for me as your father to do it."
"Yeah."
"I want a concession from you."
"What is it?"
"If you're ever in the same position you were in on the Anakin Solo, with Jason at your mercy, you take your shot only if you can do it without hate. No kidding yourself, no logical gymnastics. Without hate."
"Deal."
Ben extended his hand. Luke shook it. "Kip's coming." He glanced over his shoulder. The door slid open, revealing Kip Duren in the act of reaching for the chime button outside. Kip stepped in. "Grandmaster, Apprentice Skywalker." He held up the datapad in his other hand. "I have news." Luke rose. "From Coruscant?" "Yes." Luke moved to the table and sat, gesturing for Kip to take the seat opposite. "Let's hear it." Kip's voice became sober. "The mission group reports partial success. Colonel Solo remains at large. Master Katarn was badly injured, but has been successfully taken to a safe house. Jedi Mithrik lost his life. The others are with Katarn. The droid-piloted shuttle did not get off the ground after its landing. The surviving team members did successfully evacuate through it to the Undercity, but since it never got airborne, traces of their escape route were detected. We can anticipate that the Undercity will not be a viable approach in the future." Luke took in the news, shaking his head over Mithrik's death.
"And the package?"
"The package is on Colonel Solo." Ben frowned, puzzled.
"What's the package?"
"A tracer." Luke outlined a square about 5 centimeters across on the table surface. "About so big, black cloth. As long as it remains on Jason, we can accurately plot where he is, get a better sense of his movements."
Kashyyyk, Maytel Base.
"Hey!" Jaina's call was curt.
"Again!"
Zek looked over at her. She stood in her Jedi robes, perspiring and tense, lightsaber unlit in her hands. Zek sighed.
"Give me a minute."
"I need to practice."
"I'm not sure you can gain anything from sparring more with me. You've outstripped me with the lightsaber. Practice is all you think about day and night. I doubt any Jedi Knight can stand against you. You need to practice against a master."
"Come on!"
Her tone not wheedling, but commanding. Shaking his head, sure it was a bad idea, Zek approached her again. He thumbed on his lightsaber.
Before he could even bring it into line, Jaina gestured. The hilt popped out of his hand and flew into Jaina's grip. Anticipating her rush, he twisted out of the way as she dashed up to him. He ducked under her attack, grabbed the hilt of her own unlit lightsaber, and yanked. But she did not release it. Using his own strength to augment her move, she somersaulted over him. Then, as she landed, she kicked out, hammering the side of his knee. He fell, rolling away from her follow-up blow, and felt a chill of fear. "Hold it! End practice!" She paused, annoyed, and looked down at him. "What?"
"If I don't have a lightsaber, I can't parry."
"Well, you should hold on to yours."
She switched it off and tossed it to him. Then she retreated to her start position and took up her ready stance again.
"Come on."
"We're switching to training lightsabers."
Scowling at her, Zek moved to the pack of workout gear they had brought. He dropped his lightsaber on the blanket beside the pack. Then, from inside, he drew out two practice weapons. Made for use by Jedi trainees and apprentices, their energy blades delivered a painful shock, but no accident with one could sever an arm. Or a head.
"I'm not going to learn anything from facing a shock weapon. Come on, pick up your lightsaber."
Zek shook his head and approached her, one training weapon in each hand.
"You're not going to learn anything from practicing with me unless you switch to shock weapons, because otherwise I'm not going to be a part of it. Jaina, you're playing too rough. You're a danger to yourself and others."
"Zek, you know you can trust me."
"I know I used to be able to, before you turned into..."
Zek saw what was approaching them from the direction of the Millennium Falcon hangar, and his voice trailed off. Jaina's eyes narrowed, as though she saw through his simple trick and was offended by it. Then, either through the Force, or simply by being convinced by his expression that someone was indeed approaching, she turned to look. Walking toward them was Jason Solo. He was clad head to foot in a black guard uniform. He wore thick jack boots and thick gloves. His helmet's full-face visor concealed his features. His cape billowed behind him as he strode. Jaina's voice came as a whisper.
"Too short."
"Yeah, Vader was much taller."
"Too short even for my brother, idiot."
She raised her voice so the intruder could hear her.
"Whoever you are, that's not funny."
Reaching the edge of their practice clearing, their visitor pushed up his visor, revealing the features of Jag Fell.
"I wasn't trying to be funny, but Zek, you should have seen your face."
Zek blinked at him.
"Trying to get a date with an Alliance loyalist?"
"No."
"Because you're not going to find many on Kashyyyk."
Jag gestured at Jaina.
"I came to spar with her. You know, lightsabers."
Jaina gave him a scornful look.
"Jag, do you even know how to use a lightsaber?"
"I know lesson one. Don't grab the glowy end."
Jaina paused, obviously uncertain as to how to respond to his curious request. She walked up to face him.
"Jag, I don't want to hurt your feelings. I have every respect for you as a pilot, as a tactician, as a soldier. But in hand-to-hand combat, you're nowhere near my equal. And you can't begin to simulate Jason's abilities. I won't get anything out of a practice session, and you might get hurt."
"I might indeed."
He looked around.
"Which are the real lightsabers, and which are the fakes?"
Zek handed him one of the practice weapons.
"This is one of the safe ones."
He handed Jaina the other.
"Show him what you're talking about, Jaina. I could use the rest."
Unwillingly, she handed Zek her lightsaber.
"He knows exactly what I'm talking about. He studied Aleem Arar for years. He knows what she's capable of. I'm worse."
"Well, then this won't take too much of your time or energy."
Jag looked down at himself, then gave his thigh a slap.
"Here, give me a jolt, so I know what I'm in for."
Shaking her head in exasperation, Jaina lit the training weapon. Its violet blade leapt into life with a softer snap hiss than that of a true lightsaber. Then, slowly, she leaned over to strike Jag's leg. The blade made a cracking noise. Jag's leg jerked, a muscular spasm, and he almost fell. He put weight on it again, took a few experimental steps around.
"Ah, got it. I bet that teaches the young Jedis the virtues of not getting hit."
Zek nodded.
"It does."
"All right, let's do it. Zek, you call it."
Jag flipped his faceplate down. He thumbed his training lightsaber into life and raised it in a credible two-handed grip.
"Go."
Almost faster than the eye could follow, Jaina lunged. Jag moved his blade laterally to sweep her point out of line. A clumsy maneuver suited to a first-year sword student. Jaina disengaged before their blades met and thrust, popping her blade across the side of Jag's neck. Jag let out a yell and staggered back, patting at the point of the blow.
Wow!
Necks aren't too bad. Zek rubbed his own in sympathetic memory. Wait until you catch one across your eyelid. Or groin. Recovered, Jag stood once more in ready position.
Again.
Go.
This time Jag initiated the attack, a basic vertical slash. He was strong enough to give it a lot of power. Jaina stepped aside, and her lateral blow hit him across the upper arm.
Ow! Blast it!
Jag rubbed the spot of the injury. Jaina gave him an exasperated look.
Technically, this bout isn't over, because all I did was take your arm off, in theory. A Jedi might be able to continue for a while with a wound like that, but let's call that one a win for me.
Sounds reasonable, Jaina. You're fast.
I'm going to keep going until I think I'm fast enough. Are we done?
Oh, I'm not bright enough to be done yet.
Jag resumed the ready position.
Again.
Zek snorted, amused. Would it be wrong of me to admit that I'm really starting to enjoy this?
Yes.
Go.
Jag tried the same maneuver. Jaina stepped aside again, swung. Jag took the blow on his left forearm. The glowing blade bounced.
Jag's arm didn't twitch, didn't react at all to the electric shock.
He reached out with that arm, fast as a blaster duelist drawing and firing. He caught the hilt of Jaina's practice weapon just above her hand and squeezed. The weapon crumpled, the beam cut off. Jaina, caught off guard for only a fraction of a second, stepped back, chambered her leg, and kicked Jag in the solar plexus. His solar plexus went conk, a metallic noise. Jag wrapped his training sword against her support leg. It spasmed, and she fell. She rolled out of her fall, but Jag was already swinging in the direction of her roll. His blade caught her across the back of the neck. She completed her roll, ending up on her back, looking up at him with a pained expression.
What was that?
Jag shrugged and pushed up his visor again.
I won.
Jaina's face twisted in anger.
Flying's what you're best at, so fly!
She gestured as if pushing the air before her. Jag's feet left the ground. He hurtled backward 5 meters and crashed into the bole of the glade shade tree.
Jaina!
Zek ran up to Jag, bent over him.
What do you think you're doing?
Jag grimaced.
Punishing me for embarrassing her.
Jaina flipped acrobatically to her feet and stalked toward Jag.
I am not embarrassed! You tricked me!
She was shouting now, and Zek saw distant heads turning to look. Wookiees working in the area. Humans in the Falcon hangar.
What part of tricking you would be impossible for Alima Rar or Jason Solo to do?
Stiffly, Jag began to rise and accepted a hand from Zek for aid. Jag's gloved hand felt to Zek rigid and metallic. Once Jag was on his feet, Zek wrapped the man's forearm with his knuckles.
What have you got under there?
He repeated the experiment on Jag's chest, which also rang metallically.
The crush guns and Beskar breastplate from the other day.
Jaina came to a stop in front of Jag, almost spitting in her anger.
What are you trying to prove?
That you're training yourself to lose, to die.
That stopped her. She stared up at him, her anger vanishing in an instant, replaced by surprise and doubt.
Jaina, I've watched you for a long time now, preparing yourself for a confrontation with Alima, and you're not kidding anyone here, your brother. You've trained and trained and sweated and persevered, and as far as I can tell, you've done a brilliant job at the wrong task.
Explain that.
Her eyes searched his. Zek was surprised not to see more anger in hers.
Sword of the Jedi, that's what you are, even though nobody's sure what it means. But I'm sure of this. There are two important words there, sword and Jedi. You've been sharpening yourself into an amazing sword, but you've forgotten what it means to be a Jedi.
You're not qualified to say that.
Answer me this. What Jedi do you know who would have thrown me into that tree that hard for winning a practice bout? You didn't know my armor protected my back. You could have broken my spine. The helmet didn't protect my neck. You could have broken that. What Jedi would have done that to a friend?
She shook her head.
It was as though Jag's arguments were blaster bolts, and she was batting most of them harmlessly out of the way. But the occasional bolt was getting through, striking her, searing her.
"So, you're a good sword and a rotten Jedi. But even if you get back to being a good Jedi, you're going to die. You know why? Because you're training in Jedi skills as though you're going to have a straight-up Jedi duel with your enemies. All lightsabers and light-side force tricks. But you need to be thinking like someone who hunts Jedi. Like me."
He stepped so close to Jaina that Zek thought for a moment he was going to stoop and kiss her.
"That's what I did. And I beat you. Once."
Her words were soft, uncertain.
"The third time." "Are you absolutely sure that if I tried that tactic on our first bout, it wouldn't have worked?"
She was silent for a long moment. Then she shook her head. Jag unbuckled his helmet and took it off, holding it at his side.
"Jaina, as your commanding officer, I'm ordering you to take today off. No training, no strategizing, nothing. Report to me first thing in the morning. At that time, if you think you need another day off, I require you to tell me so. You'll get it."
"Yes, Colonel."
Coruscant.
The war raged on. Back in control of his portions of the Alliance military, and no longer distracted by Alana's absence, for, secretly, she accompanied him everywhere, smuggled between GA government buildings and the Anakin Solo in shuttles, guarded by only the most trusted officers and YVH-908, Kytus found himself stymied on some fronts, wildly successful on others. First, there was the Hape situation. Tenel Ka did not immediately turn over her fleets to his control. Instead, she withdrew them to the Hape's consortium space and cut off all communications with the Galactic Alliance and with the Confederation, with the world of Kashyyyk, and as far as anyone could tell, with the Jedi. Kytus did not know quite what to make of this maneuver. Tenel Ka could have been killed by the explosion that allowed Kytus to escape her palace, or subsequently deposed, her successor choosing to return the consortium to a neutral position. Or Tenel Ka could be taking what she must see as a terrible chance with the life of her daughter. Either way, Kytus had still been able to turn the situation into a victory. By using his intelligence resources to suggest to Confederation analysts that Tenel Ka's non-aggression treaty with them was now void, Kytus ensured that the Confederation maintained resources to monitor and safeguard against possible Hapen attack, and that gave Kytus some breathing room. Soon enough, he could determine whether Tenel Ka still ruled the consortium, get in touch with her, and persuade her that Alana's life was forfeit if she did not cooperate fully. While waiting to reach Tenel Ka, Kytus concentrated on other things, such as the Jedi. They had been quite successful at going underground after the battle at Kuat, so much so that the only sign he had seen of their activity had been the futile attack on him a few days before. He dispatched Tahiri to run down her own leads and sources to find out where the Jedi had headquartered themselves. He had thought she could simply use her association with other Jedi to find out the information. But no, it appeared that Tenel Ka had managed to communicate her suspicions of Tahiri to the other Jedi at Kuat. Tahiri still had no answers for Kytus. Meanwhile, the war raged on. With the Hapens back in play, the Alliance no longer had to worry about staging a fighting retreat. The balance of power was now once again slightly in the Alliance's favor. Kytus personally led new fleet operations at Kuat and on the outskirts of the Corellian system, commanding elements of the 5th and 2nd fleets respectively, and his Sith battle meditation ability helped his forces inflict heavy losses in both theaters of operation. Commonor retaliated for the asteroid bombardment, and in savage fashion. The first sign of it was a statistical spike in the number of head colds among humans who had recently passed through Galactic City Spaceport, civilians and military personnel alike. Within days, those head colds developed into raging fevers and dangerous dehydration, and the infection spread like Kashyyyk's forest fires through the ranks of the armed forces and the lower social classes. Left untreated, the illness could kill. It was Aflisaria, caused by an airborne bacterium, the cure for which had been discovered a century before, with the illness pronounced extinct not long after. Alana was responding with less and less enthusiasm to her time with Kytus. He had to keep his frustration in check and wait for her to get over missing her mother. Perhaps it was time to work on her a bit, to diminish her affection for Tenel Ka by judiciously erasing some of her memories here and there. Some faint misgiving stayed his hand for the time being, but if the situation continued worsening, he would take that step. And the war raged on.
Kashyyyk, Maytel Vase, hangar housing the Millennium Falcon.
Han eased the Falcon off the Duracrete roadway and into the shadow of her usual hangar. As soon as the Falcon entered the hangar and Han's eyes adjusted to the deep shadow there, he and Leia spotted a new visitor. Parked in the bay next to the Falcon's was a long yacht with curved lines and a swirling sky blue and green hull. Its exterior, too, was marred with patches of soot and burn, evidence of its own recent contribution to the firefighting mission. Han winced.
Do you suppose when Lando's back is turned, we could get some Wookiee teenagers to vandalize her? Put graffiti all over her hull?
Leia's tone was more thoughtful. I thought Lando was stationed halfway across Kashyyyk.
He was.
Lando was nowhere in sight. Han and Leia had set the Falcon down, ushered the Wookiee firefighters off, and called in for routine refueling before Lando made his appearance. The boarding ramp of the Love Commander came down, and he stood at its top, clad in purple synth silk and a flowing velvet hip cloak in black. But it wasn't the same old Lando. His face was fixed, nearly emotionless, his complexion waxy. Leia didn't wait for him to descend. She started up the ramp toward him.
Lando, what's wrong?
I have to go.
Lando managed two faltering steps down the ramp before Leia reached him. She held him there, steadied him on his feet, and turned and assisted him down the ramp. Han tried to keep his own voice steady, unperturbed, but Lando's appearance set off alarm bells in his head.
What's going on, old buddy?
At the bottom of the ramp, Lando reached into a tunic pocket. He fetched forth a data card, which he looked at blankly for a moment, before handing it to Han.
That's everything you need for the Love Commander. Registration, annotated schematic, everything. Thought I'd donate her to the cause. Firefighting, side missions. You can sell her if you're ever strapped for credits.
Lando, what's wrong?
By this point, Leia could no longer keep a sharp edge of worry out of her voice.
It's Tendra.
Leia paled, and Han felt a jolt of dread. Tendra had to be dying or already dead for Lando to be so affected. It wasn't fair. Lando had found his perfect match long after he had given up on the thought he ever would. And so much of his and Tendra's life together had been interrupted by protracted crises, including the Yuuzhan Vong War. And now this. Lando was clearly struggling to continue.
Tendra, she's gonna have a baby.
Leia froze, staring up into his shocked features.
What? What?
A smile started to spread across her face. Han sagged in relief.
Is that all? You had us really scared there. Oh, is that all?
Lando put a hand on the yacht's hull to steady himself.
Fine. You can stop being scared. Not me. I'm too old to be a father. Emperor's black bones. I'm not ready.
Leia embraced him. Lando, there are two types of people in this universe. Those who think they're not ready to be parents, and those who are kidding themselves.
Aboard the Anakin Solo.
Admiral Cha Nyathol barely waited until her GAG security escort was out of the conference room and the door shut behind them before getting to the point. She did not even bother to sit.
Sardress Koyan, Corellia's Five Worlds Prime Minister, is talking to us about changing sides.
Really? Kytus sat and leaned back in his chair. Just betraying the rest of the Confederation and risking retaliation.
My analysts suspect that the boost of hope he might have received when the Hapens withdrew from the war was lost completely when they began attacking the Confederation again, and that he would much prefer to be on the winning side.
She offered a good simulation of a human shrug.
It's not inappropriate for his psychological profile.
Koyan had been chief of state of the Corellian world of Trollis, but had been elected by a majority, though not unanimous, vote of the other chiefs of state when Dor Gedgen had been assassinated. A member of the aggressive Centerpoint Party, he had probably been seen by the other chiefs as the lesser of several evils in the succession scramble that followed Gedgen's death. What are they offering?
They want to negotiate with you. You specifically. We designate a point in space, any point equidistant between Corellia and Coruscant. The two sides bring an equal number of vessels in equivalent class ratings. You and their negotiator can negotiate either face-to-face or ship-to-ship through tight-beam transmission.
Who is their negotiator?
I do not know.
Not Koyan? Nyathol shook her head.
His profile suggests a distinct aversion to being in the company of dangerous people. This is clearly how he has survived so long.
I don't like it. No longer even pretending to be at ease, Kytus leaned forward. Even if they give us the opportunity to choose the spot for the meeting, they can communicate that information to a secondary force.
As can we.
Which can then jump to that site and attack.
As can we. They have no advantage.
Except in insisting that I be there. If their plan is intended to be an attempt on me, then success on their part, even if military losses are equivalent, disrupts our own coalition government and removes me as a strategic resource for the military. Nyathol cocked her head, a gesture of curiosity.
You are unusually cautious today, learning from Koyan himself.
Kytus opened his mouth to hurl back a retaliatory remark, then closed it again. Kytus relented, shrugging. Fine, I'll do it. Do you mind if I make an effort not to get killed when this turns out to be a trap?
Do what you need to.
I'll have units of the Second Fleet standing by to jump to the talk site, to deal with whatever forces Koyan decides to bring in.
As you wish. I'll calm the Corellians with an acceptance.
Sanctuary Moon of Endor, Jedi Outpost.
Through the transperisteel of the door, separating the waiting room from the infirmary proper, Luke studied Master Katarn's face and listened to the words of Valen and Silgal. Katarn was unconscious. Whether from drugs, pain, or voluntary immersion in a Jedi healing trance, Luke couldn't say. His face was flushed, sweating, and he looked as though he'd lost weight in the days he'd been on Coruscant. Silgal managed to impart considerable worry and sympathy into her gravelly Mon Cal voice.
The attack severed two ribs, penetrated his left lung, and exited through his left shoulder blade, a few centimeters off, and it would have gone clean through his heart. He is dehydrated and very weak, and traveling so far to get here could not have helped, except that it was still a better choice than remaining in hiding on Coruscant.
I patched him up as well as I could, as soon as possible after he was injured.
Valen sounded morose. But we had to drag him through about a kilometer of filthy pipes before we could even do that. Explosives we planted to seal our escape routes kicked dust into the air. Dust and germs. He shook his head, pained by his failure. Basic medical training isn't sufficient for a situation like that. Luke patted his shoulder. You did remarkably well. The fact that he's here alive is proof of that, and if anyone can heal him, it's Silgal. He finally turned away from studying Katarn to look at Valen. The young Jedi Knight was solemn, but not showing evidence of protracted stress or guilt. A good sign. Do you have a full report for me? Valen reached into his belt and removed a data card, which he handed to Luke.
I've flagged one or two points of interest on the report. You may want to pay special attention to them. A YVH combat droid that was programmed to get its cargo out of harm's way rather than help its master defend against four Jedi.
Luke was distracted by a stirring in the Force, the imminent arrival of others. He glanced at the two Jedi. Anything else? But the answer came from behind Luke, accompanying a bustle of several moving bodies. Boots creaked, durable uniform cloth rubbed, equipment clattered, and a new voice rose above it all.
How about some news from Corellia?
Luke turned around to see half a squadron of pilots headed his way, wearing sweat-stained orange flight suits, their helmets under their arms. They had to have just come from their starfighters. In front, familiar and reassuring, was Wedge Antilles, sharp-featured and graying. Behind, a step to the right, was Wes Jansen, his alert eyes and broad grin suggesting that he was taking copious mental notes now so that he could engage in a marathon of mockery later. Luke grinned and stepped forward to embrace his two friends. The other four pilots, two men and two women, he recognized as well.
"Thanks for coming, Wedge. Good to see you, Wes. What news from Corellia?"
Wedge looked around, noting the presence of Jedi medics and workers in this hallway.
"Maybe somewhere more private."
3 minutes later, a ground-level security door slid open before them, revealing shaded sunlight, as well as a pair of Ewoks in leather caps, stone-headed spears in hand, creeping their way a few meters beyond. As the door slid open, the Ewoks jabbered in surprise, turned and fled back into the tree line 20 meters away. Wedge snorted.
"Good neighbors, if you can stay out of their stew pots.
Come on." Luke led him out into the fresh air, heavy with the scents of blooming flowers and forest decay. The door rumbled shut behind them.
"How are Ayella and the kids?"
"Ayella's great. She's spending her time doing hollow news analysis and passing her conclusions on to me, to Booster, to Talon Card. I'll have her add you to the distribution list if you like."
"Please." Luke gestured, and the two of them headed in a different direction from that taken by the fleeing Ewoks, into the cover of deep forest.
"I don't hear much from Sile, of course. We're certainly not estranged, but since she's serving with the Alliance forces, still on the Blue Diver, and I'm an official enemy of the Alliance and an unofficial target of the Confederation, I don't get much news of her. Miri's still on the errant venture, gathering information to pass along to us, and making a fortune gambling."
He shook his head in mock distress.
"She's gonna be the first rich Antilles, and not from following an honest career. I don't know what to think of it. How's Ben?"
"Better than I have any right to expect." They were deep enough in the trees to be out of hearing range of anyone at the outpost, though still close enough to see bits of it through the screen of hanging branches and vines.
So, Corellia. A good friend of mine, a Space Navy lifer with the Corellian Defense Force. He's 90, been retired for a few years. Has just returned to active duty and assigned a recommissioned Carrick-class cruiser."
Luke offered Wedge a dubious expression. "A Carrick? What's next? Are the Corellians going to start throwing cans of food at the Alliance fleets?"
"Yes. It sounds like they're shoring up depleted units with increasing desperation. But there's more to it. My old friend is going to be a part of a special diplomatic mission to talk to the GA. A hush-hush negotiation that General Faneer, Supreme Commander of the Confederation Military Forces, wasn't informed of beforehand. Scuttlebutt has it that when he inquired about it with the Corellians, they told him it was just a delaying tactic, something to distract Colonel Solo for a few days. Now Faneer's people don't know if that's the truth, or if the Corellians are going to try to spring some sort of trap and kill Solo so they can claim the glory, and have a bargaining advantage to give them even more influence with the Confederation. Or whether they're thinking of switching sides."
Luke opened himself to the Force for a moment, but the future remained impossibly distant and unclear. "We have a means to track Jason's movements, but that leaves us very reactive. He goes, and if we respond in time, we can follow him. To anticipate his movements would be ideal."
2 days until the meeting with the Corellians. 2 days at a halfway point between Corellia and Coruscant, but that's still a lot of space to cover."
Wedge frowned, calculating.
"In 2 days, if you could have a Stealth X shadow the Anakin Solo out of the Coruscant system, that might give us the exact coordinates. Her course, plus knowledge that the destination will be identical in distance from there to Corellia as well."
"Right. If we're lucky and he doesn't send the Anakin Solo through an elaborate multiple-leg course."
"I doubt he will. Whether it is one or not, he has to suspect that it's a trap. Why worry about elaborate routing when you're going directly to the adversary anyway?"
"True." Luke nodded. "I'll send out a Stealth X immediately."
Aboard the Anakin Solo.
Kytus relaxed in his command salon, away from the bustle and noise of the bridge, waiting for the exit from Coruscant space and the short hyperspace jump to the rendezvous point with the Corellian task force. He would have preferred to pass the time in one of two secret rooms near his quarters, Alana's playroom or his cramped workshop, where finally, he was finding the time to build his new lightsaber.
it would be a proper lightsaber, with a red blade, the better to announce his new role as Lord of the Sith. Though when it would be time to make that declaration, he still did not know. The monitor before him, showing nothing but stars and tiny fast-moving dots that constituted traffic inbound toward Coruscant, suddenly switched to the face of Lieutenant Tabut, a dark-haired human woman with a quiet, no-nonsense manner and an imposing air of efficiency.
"The pilot reports readiness for hyperspace jump," Tabut reported, "but we're being hailed by a private yacht identifying itself as Love Commander."
Kydus grimaced and briefly considered blowing the vehicle out of space. But no. Lando was only nearly useless, and the old gambler's instinct for self-preservation meant that he often had some helpful information at hand. Kydus pressed a button so that his next words would also go to Captain Neville. "All stop." He released it and looked at the monitor again. "Put her captain through to me." He waited just long enough for the picture on his display to change from Tabut's face before he began talking. "Calrissian, give me one good reason..." But the face that materialized on the display was not that of Lando Calrissian. It was Leia Organa Solo. "Mother?" Leia gave him a slight smile. It seemed to Kydus to be a very sad one.
"Oh, I'm not Mom anymore?"
"Not really, no. What do you need? I'm in a bit of a hurry."
"I need to speak to you."
"And without Father?" Kydus frowned. "Where is the Falcon?"
"Back on Kashyyyk, putting out fires. Fires you started."
"Yes, fires to punish an enemy of the Alliance. As I must point out, you are an enemy of the Alliance. Is there some reason I shouldn't start a fire in that ridiculous yacht of Lando's right now?"
"The same reason as before. I need to talk to you."
"That's your need, not mine." Leia simply stared at him, silent, implacable. She had to be up to something. Kydus tried to detect what he could of her through the Force. He could sense her, a bright and distinctive presence, alone on the yacht. Interesting. So Han wasn't with her, nor were there any strangers present. No assassins who might be targeting him. No Hapens come to retrieve Alana. He sighed as if giving in. "Very well. Come aboard, my personal hangar bay. You'll be escorted to the command salon."
"Understood."
Minutes later, two security guards entered the command salon, with Leia between them. They presented a ridiculous picture. Two tall men in crisp uniforms, their buckles, buttons, visors, and blasters gleaming, flanking a diminutive graying woman in plain Jedi robes. Kydus gestured at the guards. They spun and left the salon. The door shut behind them. He didn't bother to keep impatience and indifference out of his voice. "Well?" Leia looked him over.
"Jason, it's time for you to look at yourself." "I'm well aware of what I look like, Mother. I have to cultivate my image carefully for Holonews appearances." "I'm not talking about your looks. I'm talking about your life."
He sighed.
"You know, I was actually hoping you would come up with some exciting, imaginative new argument to sway me from my path. Not that it has a chance of succeeding, but it would be more entertaining. Don't you have some new heart-wrenching appeal? Some brilliant metaphor to hurl at me and cause me to double over in the anguish of guilt? To reevaluate my whole ethical structure?"
She shook her head, and there was no missing the sadness in her eyes.
"All I have is the truth, and the memory of who you used to be."
He pressed a button on the arm of his chair. The door behind Leia slid open.
"You're wasting my time. Leave, now."
She glanced at the button, and it clicked down without Kydus' help. The door slid closed again.
"You no longer have time for me? Which you? The mother you used to be? Or the interplanetary criminal you've become? I'm not the only one who's changed. History decides who's a criminal, Jason."
Finally, real irritation began to stir with Kydus, and he rose to the argument.
"No, the law decides who's a criminal. History just forgives them, and for reasons as stupid as they are varied. Han Solo was a spice smuggler, an unapologetic lawbreaker. You, even when you were a teenager, were a traitor to the legitimate galactic government, a conspirator planning war and overthrow. The puppet government you put in place may have forgiven you both, but you'll be criminals for the rest of your lives." Her expression graduated to scorn. Have you ever studied Darth Vader? Clearly, you got your intelligence and your political acumen from your grandfather. He nodded. There, we are in agreement. In the private hangar bay set aside for the use of Anakin Solo's commander, a team of security specialists carrying standard scanning gear walked down the yacht's boarding ramp. Moments after the last one reached the hangar floor, the ramp rose into place, sealing the yacht. Jaina Solo, stretched out on her back in an oppressively enclosed space, watched them leave. She did not watch them directly, but through the portable monitor she held in her hands. A shielded data feed led from the device into the metal wall of this smuggling compartment. Beside her, Han stirred but did not open his eyes.
Are they gone?
Jaina twisted a dial at the bottom of the screen, flipping its view through all of the Love Commander's exterior holocam feeds.
No, they're walking the yacht perimeter doing a final scan.
Irritated, she checked her chrono.
How long can Mom keep Jason distracted?
Han shrugged.
Hard to guess.
An ominous scratching sounded from the far end of the compartment. Jaina looked past her feet to the cage situated there on the compartment floor. A cube, 1 meter in each dimension. It was made of thin, brightly painted Durasteel bars. Within it was a jagged piece of polymer shaped like a stunted tree bowl, and holding onto the sculpture was a reptile, a little over a meter long, greenish, with two sets of clawed legs and a long tail. It stared at them as if waiting for a reply to its statement. Jaina wrinkled her nose at it.
I hate that thing.
It was an Isalamiri, a lizard from the world of Merkur, one of a species that had long ago evolved the ability to project an invisible bubble of force energy in counterbalance to the force all around it, making everything inside its border undetectable by force sensitives outside its range. So long as Jaina and Han and Zek and Jag in the next compartment remained nearby, Jason could not detect them. Movement on the monitor drew Jaina's attention.
Sensor crew's leaving, but there's still two guards on the exit, and two just outside.
Han leaned over to peer at the monitor.
Got the hangar holocams picked out?
Jaina nodded.
Yeah, Jason's shuttle is right here, in this hangar.
Let's go.
Han exerted himself against the Durasteel panel directly overhead, and it swung open, admitting cool air from the Love Commander's atmosphere conditioners. They executed their plan in several stages, each accomplished very quickly and with the precision that only Jedi and someone like Han Solo could manage. Silently, the four exited the Love Commander through a cargo hatch in the blind spot between her starboard side and the massive maintenance machinery immediately beside her. Jaina, carrying the electronics package, whose construction had been supervised by Aiella Antilles, a package now disguised as a mouse droid, reached a wall data jack and plugged the package in. Its code, optimized not only for this task, but for this specific vessel as well, sampled hangar holocam feeds, looped them, and extracted visual glitches such as glow rod flickers that might alert viewers they were watching a recording. Then the programming subverted security measures, not the ship's main programming, just those pertaining to the holocams, and began sending the looped recordings instead of the live feeds to the bridge. Next, as Han and Jag covered the door from concealed positions, Jaina and Zek rushed the guards there. The advantage of surprise allowed them to cross meters of distance before the guards could bring their blaster rifles into line, and a few swift blows put them down. The Jedi dragged them aside, out of sight of the door. The third stage was just as potentially dangerous and just as successful. The four of them positioned themselves out of sight of the hangar doors, two to either side, and then opened them. They heard a surprised exchange from the guards there, but no footsteps suggesting additional traffic out in the corridor. Blaster rifles at the ready, the two guards stepped into the hangar. As the pair caught sight of the intruders in their peripheral vision, Jag hit the button to shut the doors. Jaina and Zek stepped forward and launched attacks. Jaina's kick took her target clean off his feet, breaking ribs despite his chest armor, sending him into deep unconsciousness. But Zek's opponent, clearly an experienced hand-to-hand combatant, blocked Zek's punch with his rifle butt and swung the barrel around to fire. So Han shot him in the face. His blaster pistol was set on stun, and the guard merely spasmed and fell. Zek breathed a relieved sigh, not at the removal of danger, but at his opponent's size.
This one's big enough.
Get into his armor and get going. Jaina took up her AirSat's mouse droid and headed toward Jason's shuttle.
Yes, boss.
Han helped Zek strip the armor from the tallest guard and don it. Zek stood and swept his long hair up to the top of his head, holding it there while Han put the last piece of armor, his helmet, in place. Zek pulled the helmet down low and picked up the guard's blaster rifle.
Next stop, tractor beams, and the installation of some very specialized holocom gear. Han gave him a lopsided smile. Jason's gonna get sick of people improving his ship. Good.
So if you believe that Palpatine's rule as Emperor was legitimate, you have to believe that any government, no matter how destructive, is legitimate.
Leia practically spat the words out.
Why did we bother taking back Coruscant from the Yuuzhan Vong? By your figuring, they were legitimate rulers of the galaxy.
Kaidus stirred, irritated, but did not rise. That's not what I said, and don't put words in my mouth. Palpatine worked within the system to gain prominence. That establishes a continuity of government. That's part of the legitimacy. What you did with the rebels, like what the Yuuzhan Vong did, was come in like an agricultural planet former, digging up and destroying everything in its path.
A second set of doors, the ones leading forward to the bridge, opened. Lieutenant T'Boot stood there.
Grateful for the reprieve, Kaida swiveled his chair toward her.
Yes? We've dropped out of hyperspace, Colonel. We're at the negotiation site.
Thank you. Kaidus rose. Come to the bridge, Mother. In the unlikely event that this is not some sort of trap by your Confederation friends, you might witness a successful negotiation for their legitimate return to the Galactic Alliance.
Leia accompanied him to the door. I can't root for either result. You don't deserve to negotiate and benefit from a peace, and I don't want to be here if it's a trap.
Behind T'Boot, they walked through into the bridge and were assailed by all its usual noise. Chatter of officers at their stations in the pits to either side of the main walkway, the hum of computers and other machinery, the distorted and modulated voices of personnel coming across comm frequencies and intercoms. Kaidus marched up the walkway to the vast viewports at the bow end. He could see the hull of the Anakin Solo stretching away below and before him, with the domes of its gravity well generators protruding like habitat shells, and the distant, slightly irregular shapes of enemy ships among the unwinking stars.
Report!
The officer in the sensor station, a woman with a Coruscanti accent, called up.
They dropped out of hyperspace 30 seconds after we did. Their numbers match ours, ship for ship. We're running data on the ships themselves. The Anakin's opposite number is the Star Destroyer Valorum.
Valorum? Kaidus's surprise was genuine.
Intelligence. Best guess. Did they name her for one of Palpatine's political opponents to goad me?
No, sir.
The man at the intelligence station was dark-skinned. Though young, he was completely bald, and his accent suggested worlds of the unknown regions.
That was her original name up on launch, about 60 years ago. She's Victory Class, from the last years of the Old Republic.
Kaidus turned to his mother. Ancient hardware. They're getting desperate. Leia nodded.
Which affects the chances of this being a legitimate negotiation and a trap equally. So it's information, but not informative.
Stop trying to teach me politics, Mother. I've already attained the highest rank you ever did.
And I'm not done yet. Except that I attained it by being elected to it, not by rewriting the law and jailing my predecessor.
Kaidus turned away, shaking his head.
Communications. Has the enemy initiated comm contact?
Lieutenant T'Boot, back at her station, nodded.
Yes, sir. They've sent routine greetings and asked for you.
Let them wait.
Have we established contact with the blue diver? Yes, sir.
Put her on holo.
A moment later, a hologram swam into resolution before Kaidus and Leia. It showed a female of the Duros people, with bluish skin, large red eyes, and a lipless slit for a mouth, with no nose above it. She wore a white admiral's uniform. She nodded to Kaidus.
Colonel?
Recognizing Leia, she nodded again, her voice taking on a slight note of surprise.
Jedi Solo?
No, Admiral Limpan. Sadly, my mother has not seen the light of reason and rejoined the Alliance. Are you on station?
We are.
Kaidus glanced his mother's way.
I plan no violation of the terms of our meeting today, Mother. But if they spring a trap, I have elements of the Second Fleet standing by to jump in as a little surprise.
Speaking of surprises, Admiral, if our holocom contact is broken for more than 15 seconds, consider that authorization to jump in. They could always manage some sort of sabotage or jamming to break contact between us.
Understood. Anakin Solo standing for...
tweeted, indicating that he had received a message, and the intelligence officer called.
That's the breakdown of enemy forces, sir. All old ships, some of them nearly derelicts. Some are still listed as decommissioned.
Kytus didn't bother to read the listing. Very good. Communications, put the enemy commander on. Let's get this farce moving. There was no hologram this time. The Valorum was either too old to have a holotransmitter or too strapped for resources to use one. Monitors all over the bridge, including those near the bow viewports, flickered simultaneously to show an aging woman, long-faced, in the uniform of a Corellian Defense Force captain. Kytus moved up to stand before one of the monitors.
A captain? They sent only a naval captain for this negotiation?
Captain Hopclaw.
The Corellian woman gave him a nod of mock-friendly greeting.
Technically, you're a colonel, as I recall, but we both have the power and authority to enter into binding negotiations.
Jag and Han got the panel covering the main motivators for the hangar exterior doors down and to the floor, revealing the machinery beyond. Jag shook his head.
I do fine with mechanical gear, but I prefer to have manuals and charts on hand. Jane is better at this sort of thing than I am.
Han smiled in combined pride and self-appreciation.
Don't worry. She got it from me.
He pointed a long, calloused forefinger at an expansive cluster of chips.
The main security module will be there. We just have to figure out which chip.
Out of, 300 or so?
Sure, no problem.
Han took a moment to wave at his daughter, who was visible in the bridge viewport of Jason's shuttle, then bent for his toolkit.
Just stand back and learn something.
Alone, all but forgotten except by a black-clad guardsman at the door into the command salon who watched her every movement, Leia stood listening to the exchange between her son and the Corellian captain. Frowning, she moved to a monitor at the stern end of the bridge and leaned in so close that her right ear was adjacent to the device's main speaker. She shook her head and returned to the center of the bridge walkway, then stepped clean off it, dropping nimbly to land beside the bald-headed intelligence officer who had been providing Jason with data. Rather than being alarmed, he offered her a sardonic smile.
Is this an attack?
If it were, it would be over by now. Can you give me an isolated audio feed of just the Corellian side of the transmission so I can hear it without all this ambient noise?
I could, of course, but I won't. Technically, you're a prisoner of war.
You mean I'm the enemy?
Yes, that's what I mean.
I'm also Colonel Solo's mother, and this vessel was named for my other son. I don't want to see either one destroyed, which might happen if my worst-case suspicions turn out to be true, and I don't get some cooperation.
The officer looked at her for a long moment, then sighed. Over Leia's shoulder, he called,
Tibboot, isolation helmet, please.
Tibboot opened a cabinet drawer beside her station and withdrew a helmet. She lobbed it to the intelligence officer, who then handed it to Leia. She donned it and immediately heard Captain Hawklaw speaking.
Asking us to bear a tremendously disproportionate burden of the cost of rebuilding. If I agree to the numbers you suggest, the Corellian system would be reduced to poverty for generations.
There was a long pause.
No, that's not justice, that's vindictiveness, and it presupposes that the entire burden of blame, that every wrong in the course of these events, should be laid at the feet of the Corellian government.
There was no other noise, no background conversation, no clattering of fingers across keyboards. Hastily, Leia removed the helmet.
Can you send a message, a text message, to Jason's monitor so he can read it, but Captain Hawklaw can't see it?
Of course.
Impatient, Jaina glanced at her chrono. Leia had to be doing a magnificent job of delaying Jason, but even so, they couldn't stay here forever. Her mouse droid had drunk in much of the raw telemetry data from the shuttle's memory, but there was plenty more to go. She saw Jack turn away from helping her father, and blaster pistol drawn, trot over to the hangar's internal doors. He keyed a command to open them and stayed to one side, pistol aimed. But it was Zek, still in Alliance armor, who marched in. As soon as the doors slid shut again, the tall Jedi relaxed. Talking with Jag, he caught sight of Jaina. First appraised, he waved to her, a gesture of success. She nodded. One more task down. But they couldn't relax, couldn't lose focus. Could never, ever lose focus. As Kytus continued expressing his very reasonable demands, words appeared at the bottom of his monitor screen. Jedi Solo reports no bridge or personnel noises in enemy transmission. Communications has analyzed and confirms, suggests enemy command ship bears only skeleton crew or is automated. Despite the distraction, Kytus did not miss the import of Captain Hawklaw's last words. Step down? Why would I?
Because if you do, we might be able to transform this conversation from a simple negotiation to a genuine peace. We might bring an end to this war.
Kytus felt a flash of irritation. That's not on the table, Captain. He was also growing impatient. Why had the Confederates not sprung their trap? Perhaps they would not until it became clear that the negotiations could not, would not succeed.
Captain, you've heard my terms. I will not budge on any of them. In fact, as I grow annoyed with you, I will make them harsher. I'll give you 10 standard minutes to accept them as is. If you do not, when we begin talking again, you'll be in a worse bargaining position.
He switched off the monitor, and to boot, alert, cut the transmission altogether. Kytus turned. The bridge walkway behind him was empty.
Where is Jedi Solo?
The intelligence officer gestured toward the doors at the stern end of the bridge.
The guard there accompanied her back into the command salon.
Ah. Kytus concealed the sudden chill those words stabbed into his heart.
I'll be back in 10 minutes.
At a trot, Darth Kytus headed aft for what he hoped would not be a confrontation with his mother.
Center Point Station. Fire Control Chamber.
As with every such enterprise, the use of an unbelievably complicated, incalculably important piece of machinery in the hands of the military, the involved parties were divided into groups, each of them secretly condescending to and uncomprehending of the others. In the control areas of this large chamber, where consoles, keyboards, monitors, readouts, and data jacks predominated, technicians were hard at work. They analyzed energy throughputs, calculated damage to systems from anticipated energy spikes, theorized about side effects, and discussed recent hypotheses about the physics of gravity. In one open area, where once a twice-human-height droid that had believed it was Anakin Solo had lived and died, military officers in their uniforms of the Corellian Defense Force now waited. One of them, a woman in white instead of the lower-ranking browns, irritably consulted her chrono. Tall and broad-shouldered, she had an intelligent expression and a gaze that moved everywhere in the chamber, cataloging hundreds of details and events. The third group, nearest the doors leading out of this chamber, was made up of government representatives. Sadrus Koyan, a short, burly man with thinning hair and an aggressive manner, had a gaze as sweeping and restless as that of the white-uniformed woman. But he seemed less to be registering details and waiting for some signal to satisfy his impatience. Beside him stood Denjax Tepler, a younger man with bland but confidence-inspiring features. Tepler had worn many occupational hats since the crisis had begun in Corellia. He was now Minister of Information, a post disparagingly and accurately referred to in other offices as Minister of Propaganda. Finally, Koyan's patience broke.
"What's the holdup, Admiral Delpin?"
The woman in the white uniform moved toward him.
"Sim firings are suggesting an unacceptable chance of catastrophic failure. We're locking down and locking out the subsystems that are most likely to be damaged by overloads. It's just a matter of a few minutes."
"Solo is going to jump out of there before we can even get the thing online," Koyan shouted.
One of the technicians at the control board nodded in response to something he heard over his earpiece. He turned and flashed five fingers at Admiral Delpin. She, in turn, caught Koyan's eye. 5 minutes.
Star system MZX-32905, near Bimil.
Alima wondered about worshippers. Now that she was a goddess, she should have some. At the moment, of course, she did not look very goddess-like. She sat in the topmost chamber of Lumaya's former habitat, the chamber with the curved bookcase-laden walls and transparisteel dome, in a ridiculously comfortable stuffed chair. In her old body, the crippled one. In moments, though, she would shed that body again, float free through the galaxy, restore balance to the universe, and please herself. How stupid Lumaya had been to use this gift to further some ancient Sith agenda. Speaking of the Sith, she would have to deal with them soon. Once she had reduced Leia to a tearful, useless wreck, as she imagined Luke now to be, she would turn her attention to Korriban and begin to exterminate the dangerous pest colony the Sith enclave there constituted. It would take time. Her last projection to Kashyyyk had tired her immensely. She had slept for days afterward. Alima relaxed, closing her eyes, and invited the immense pool of dark power waiting hundreds of meters below her in the asteroid proper to ascend to her, to flow through her. She stiffened as she felt the power grope its way blindly toward where she reclined. As it washed across her, it seemed to be half hot waterfall, half galvanizing electric current, but too full of malicious emotion to be cleansing or refreshing. It imparted to her a sense of greater power and destiny, yes, but it was also an invasion of herself, and that part of it she did not relish. Now, fully intermingled with the dark power, she set her mind adrift, looking for familiar presences in the Force. She knew where to start looking, at the cluster of presences where long-life patients warred with animalistic strength and rage. The world of the Wookiees. But Han and Leia were not among those presences. Vexed, Alima broadened her search. Minutes passed, with each minute taxing her personal energy further. And then she found them. Not together, but close by each other, with thousands of lives around them, but only thousands, not millions or billions. That suggested they were on a ship somewhere between worlds. She propelled herself to be near them, then went looking among the other presences, the other glows in the Force, for one that would be suitable. Some radiated too brightly. They would be too strong for her to merge with. Others were too dim. They would not anchor her as she needed to be anchored. One stood out. It was bright with power, but very pure, not marked by anger or sophistication. She circled in toward it, charmed by its simplicity, its innocence. As she touched it, she decided that it was a child, a human girl asleep. The child stirred as Alima reached her, almost coming awake, but Alima poured out comforting thoughts through the Force. Emotions of safety and security, of being in the nest, surrounded by thousands like her, all clicking and whirring on their many legs, all nearly identical. Her emotions did not so much soothe as stifle the child, but that was enough. Alima wrapped herself around the girl. Now she was fixed in that place. She had a base from which to go hunting. She went looking for Han Solo.
Aboard the Anakin Solo.
Kaidus strode into his command salon. Only officers were there. Where are Jedi Solo and the guard? Captain Neville pointed toward the stern doors out of the salon.
Princess Leia asked for some privacy. The guard accompanied her to your private office.
The chill in Kaidus' heart intensified. Without answering, he dashed toward the doors. Moments later, he entered his private office. The guard, a muscular man with yellow skin, was there, slumped in Kaidus' desk chair, unconscious.
Leia was nowhere to be seen. Kytus brought his desk monitor and clicked it over instantly to his secret chambers, where Alana now lived. There she was, curled up on a little daybed. He thumbed his comlink to life.
Security, find Jedi Solo and report her location to me.
At once, sir.
But it wasn't at once. 30 agonizingly long seconds went by. Then the voice returned.
Sir, she's approaching your personal hangar bay.
Alone?
Alone, sir.
Alert the guards there. Secure both the internal and external bay doors.
Yes, sir.
There was a pause.
Doors secured remotely, sir, but the door guards aren't responding. There's no sign of them on holocam.
Thoughts clicked through Kytus' mind like Sabacc cards going through an automated shuffler. She was under observation until moments ago, so she couldn't have gotten rid of the guards herself. Conclusion? She has allies aboard, or she smuggled in allies on her yacht. Probably the latter. She doesn't have Alana, so Alana was not the goal of her mission. But to be sure, Kytus moved to the wall panel concealing the secret door that led to those chambers. It opened before him, and he stepped through into one of the best-kept secrets aboard ship. The narrow corridor led aft to a succession of small rooms that almost no one living knew about. A few steps later, another door opened for him, presenting him with the same happy view of Alana he had seen on his monitor. She opened her eyes, groggy, and yawned.
No more work?
I'm sorry. Lots more work. But I wanted to stop in to look at you.
I dreamed there was a lady here.
Well, have another good dream. I'll be back soon. He smiled, then stepped out again and let the door shut behind him. Remembering the stratagem he'd used on Hapes, Kytus felt a new fear. Perhaps Leia and accomplices had brought a bomb aboard. He never would have suspected it of her, but the idea had a beautiful simplicity to it. A sufficiently large explosion in his private hangar would cripple or destroy the Anakin Solo. Worse, it would harm or kill Alana. He spun, re-entered the room he had just left, and smiled down at his daughter. I was wrong. Work is done for a little while. Let's go for a fun ride.
Centerpoint Station, Fire Control Chamber.
The chief technician's voice was quiet and somber.
Anakin Solo imprinting lockout bypasses are holding. Energy charge is holding. Targeting system is holding. We read ready.
Admiral Delpin nodded.
Acknowledge ready.
She turned Coyne's way.
We await your authorization to launch.
Coyne gulped.
Launch authorized. Admiral Delpin, I also authorize you to fire the weapon. Don't wait for me to authorize. Fire when you think the moment is perfect.
Acknowledged.
Delpin raised her comlink.
Force Yimmy, move in. Force Zex, all squadrons, make your jump and commence your attack.
She paused long enough to hear two confirmations, then turned back toward Koyan.
We're committed.
Aboard the Anakin Solo.
The little personnel speeder, Kytus at the controls, hurtled down the main passageway of the Anakin Solo, causing crew members, uniformed pilots, and civilian observers to leap cursing out of its way. In the passenger seat, strapped down tight, Alana laughed. A child's throaty chuckle Kytus could hear even over the roar of the repulsor lifts. Ordinarily, he would have been charmed. Now, he was simply alarmed. He would remain so until he was off the Anakin Solo and away from whatever it was Leia had brought aboard. He sideslipped into a pedestrian downramp, causing a half-squad of infantry to dive over a railing to avoid him. Alana laughed again. He glanced at her and forced a smile. Having fun?
Lots of fun. Can I drive?
Next time, sweetie. Finally, there they were. Double doors leading into the main starfighter bay. They slid aside at his approach. He roared in, clearing mechanics standing on either side of the door by a handspan. He glanced at the arrayed ranks of starfighters, old and new, trusted and experimental, and veered toward the line of various TIE series. One in particular, an experimental design he'd flown once, drew his eye. The prototype TIE reconnaissance fighter, nicknamed the Blur by GA pilots, resembled the old TIE bomber. It had low profile, curved solar array wings, and two cylindrical fuselages mounted side by side.
making the vessel look curiously like a pair of macro binoculars mounted between a pair of cupped hands. Unlike the situation with the original bomber, the portside pod on the Blur was an electronics housing, carrying a modern-era hyperdrive, astro-navigation computers, a shield generator, life support systems, and sophisticated electronic countermeasures. It was the closest thing to a Stealth X to come out of Cenar, its manufacturer. This Blur was painted in black, undecorated except for small Galactic Alliance symbols on the outer wings. Kaida slewed to a stop beside the Blur and was unstrapping Alana as a mechanic ran up to him.
"Can I help you, sir?"
Kaida lifted Alana out of her seat. "I'm taking the Blur out."
Yes, sir, but Captain Olivet is doing a test run in 15 minutes, a sweep near the Confederation Task Force.
"Push it back." Not waiting for a boarding ladder, Kaida leapt atop the Blur and lifted the boarding hatch. "You fill out the forms for me."
Yes, sir.
Kaidas' comlink beeped. Carefully, he clambered with Alana down into the cockpit, pulled the hatch shut, and settled into the pilot's couch before answering. "Yes?" It was his sensor officer.
"Sir, 16 squadrons of starfighters have dropped out of hyperspace. They're heading toward us at full speed. The Confederation capital ships are also moving in."
"Signal Admiral Impan. Tell her to bring her task force in now. Launch all starfighters from all vessels." As he spoke, Kaidas powered up the Blur and glanced his way through an abbreviated pre-flight checklist. "Move the Anakin Solo to the rear of our formation, and do not bring up our shields until the last possible moment, or until the diagnostics that are running pronounce them safe, whichever comes first."
"Yes, sir."
"I'm launching now." Alana in his lap, Kaidas finished pulling webbing tight over the two of them, then activated the Blur's repulsors. The main hangar doors themselves began to draw aside, revealing Starfield below. Kaidas didn't wait for them to finish opening. He banked across and dropped through the half-open portal, eliciting a squeal of delight from Alana. And then he was outside, away from the life-threatening explosion he was sure the Anakin Solo represented. Kaidas breathed easier for a minute. Outside, surrounded by a hard vacuum with enemy starfighters and capital ships racing in his direction, at last, he felt safe.
Aboard the Anakin Solo, Jason Solo's private hangar.
Leia marched through the doors and Jag hit a series of buttons on the keypad beside them, closing and locking them. Han, visible through the viewport of the Love Commander cockpit, waved. Then his voice crackled across the comlink.
"Sweetheart, get aboard! We've got it, and it's time to fly!"
Leia put on a force-augmented burst of speed and dashed up the yacht's boarding ramp. She heard Jag hurrying in her wake. Zek was just inside the yacht's main cabin, standing by to seal the exit hatch. Leia moved forward to the cockpit, where Han occupied the pilot's seat, Jaina the co-pilot's. Leia dropped into the captain's chair, which Lando formerly had occupied.
"We're in deep space, about halfway between Coruscant and Corellia. Jason's occupied talking to the Corellians. Now might be the time to go."
Han half-turned and cocked his head at her.
"Maybe, maybe not. They've already tried to lock you out, lock us in, and depressurize this hangar. They don't want us to leave. The question is, are they tractor beam angry or turbo laser angry?"
"Good question, but Zek disabled the tractor beam." In the manner of a cantina drink hustler, Leia batted her eyes at her husband. "Surely you can outfly a few little old turbo laser beams."
Han scowled.
"In that case, strap in tight."
Kaidas brought the Blur around and above the Anakin Solo, giving him an unimpeded view of the vessel and open space before it. Alana cooed with appreciation at the vista of stars and ships. Suddenly, there were more ships. A bluish streak resolved itself into the curved, graceful lines of the Mon Cal cruiser Blue Diver, flagship of the GA Second Fleet, forward in port to the Blur's position. Other capital ships, a score of them, ended their hyperspace jumps in formation all around the vessels already on station. Starfighters now began to stream out of the Anakin Solo's belly, and the starfighter bays of other vessels like piranha beetles swarming out of a just-damaged nest. A light appeared on his comm board, and he heard Admiral Limpan's voice.
"Sir, I'm arraying us in battle diamond formation, overlapping fields of fire to deal with the starfighter problem, and holding here. since they seem anxious to do all the work. Unless you have other specific orders.
No, Admiral. I'll monitor from here and maybe assist in defending against the starfighters. And maybe not.
That seems to be an unnecessary risk, sir.
But an opportunity to test out the capabilities of the blur.
Yes, sir.
The light faded. Alana's voice chided him.
You're working again.
Sorry, sweetie. Something came up. He banked to port and climbed well above the blue diver's relative altitude, activating the blur's electronic countermeasures as he did so. In moments, he was well outside the GA formation, and, he hoped, not registering on enemy sensors. Jaina's comms signal activated the receiver and chip Han and Jag had planted in the outer door machinery. Rows of warning lights flashed around the outer doors, indicating that the atmosphere shield was being activated. Moments later, the doors slid aside, revealing a number of capital ships looming in the starfield. Han eased the yoke forward. The Love Commander glided to the entryway, and her prow emerged through the atmosphere shield. But Han did not increase thrust for a run into space. As the yacht's nose entered vacuum, Han meticulously turned to port, toward Anakin Solo's stern. Leaving the hangar, the yacht maintained a distance of less than 2 meters from the Star Destroyer's hull, too close for the ship's guns to target him. Jaina nodded. Nice. Slow as a teenager taking her first speeder parking test, but nice. Han shot her a dirty look.
Now we just have to find the perfect time to make our run for it.
Jag and Zek were just strapping themselves in to couches in the yacht's den, plush, embarrassingly comfortable couches, when Ali Marar emerged from the hatch to the stern refresher. Her smile was all innocence.
Hello, boys. Does Han Solo have a moment for us?
Zek was up in an instant, his lightsaber igniting with a snap hiss. Alima raised her own from beneath her black robes and ignited it. Unbuckling and rising, Jag turned toward the cockpit.
Trouble! Alima!
Facing Alima again, he did not bother drawing his blaster. He knew the futility of that, at least while she had him in sight. Instead, he reached for the large travel bag at his feet, rummaged through it, and brought out a helmet. It had a large visored slit over the eyes rather than a full faceplate, and was an undecorated burnished gray in color. Swathed as Alima was in her robes, it was hard to tell whether this was the maimed Twi'lek he had followed for years, or the miraculously cured one Han, Leia, and Waru had faced on Kashyyyk. But her face, unblemished, no sign of muscle damage or old breaks to the cheekbone, suggested that it was the latter. He caught Zek's eye and shook his head. Then Jag slipped on his helmet, powering up its internal system with a flick of the switch under its collar. Alima attacked, lunging at Zek with speed surpassing that with which her Jedi training should have allowed her. The tall Jedi parried, trying to bind Alima's blade with his own. But her attack was not in earnest. Alima's movement carried her past him in a rolling dive that would have sent her over his most likely counterstrike, had he thrown one. She hit the compartment's carpeted floor past him, rolled to her feet, and speed, undiminished, charged into the narrow passageway leading to the cockpit. Jag heard the buzz and crackle of lightsaber striking lightsaber. Alima immediately backed into the compartment again, the two of them exchanging lightning-fast blows with their weapons. But where Alima was genuinely striking at Leia's neck, waist, and limbs, Leia looked like a stage performer, her blows designed to connect with her opponent's blade, and nothing else. Even Jag, no swordsman, could see Leia pass up an opportunity to cut the Twi'lek down. Jag cycled through the helmet's suite of sensors, looking at Alima for a few seconds with each. Primary sensors showed everyone present as a fuzzy image. Flesh did not reflect sensor pings as well as hard surfaces, but Alima was even fuzzier than the others. Under infrared, where Leia was varied shades of green, clothing in different areas of the body showing up as slightly different intensities, Alima was a homogeneous color, the same exact hue from head to foot, except for her lightsaber blade, which radiated far more brightly. Experimentally, he launched a sonar ping. Registering higher than the range of hearing of most species, it was not audible, but it returned an image about as crude as that of his radar set, and Alima was nowhere on that image. Jag smiled.
as she danced before Leia, alternately advancing and retreating. Alima failed to guard her back from possible assaults by Zek. The tall Jedi stood inert, as though he were not tempted. When Alima's retreat threatened to run her into him, Zek merely stepped aside, giving the two women room to maneuver.
How gallant!
There was contempt in Alima's words as she left off hammering at Leia to glare at Zek.
Well, we will simply have to kill you one at a time instead of all together. Unless Han Solo wishes to come out and save you trouble by dying nobly, of course. Who will be first?
None of them moved. None but Jack, who gestured toward the stern.
Airlock's that way. Fight us!
Leia shook her head. I'm sorry, Alima. We're just not that bored. Alima gaped at her. Then realization dawned.
You know. Who told you?
Jag shrugged.
Lumaya, of course. She hated you, you know. Liar!
Alima sprang at him, her anger and speed catching Jag flat-footed. But Leia was there first, interposing her blade, catching Alima's attack and blocking it, a dismissive expression on her face. If you just want some more sword training, Alima, come back to the Order. Luke will whistle you up a youngling to practice against. Alima glared at Leia. Then she wavered. This was not the waver of a person who was tired. It looked instead as though Alima were painted onto a sail that had just caught the first gust of morning wind. She rippled at her waist, and the ripple spread in both directions to her head and her feet. Then, she was gone, as if she had never been there. Jag took a deep breath.
Thanks, Leia.
She deactivated her lightsaber.
You might think about learning to dodge. Did you get anything useful?
He grinned.
Lots.
The stealth exes of Red Sword Flight, Luke, Kip, Corrin, Tyria Tainer, the Rodian Tool, and Sonola Tee of Dathomir dropped out of hyperspace and were confronted with the vista of the Galactic Alliance Task Force drawn up in tight formation, the Confederation Task Force approaching it in some sort of suicidal spread-out array, and a furious screen of starfighter dogfights raging between them. Luke felt a distraction, something drawing his attention away from the engagement zone toward an empty area of space far to the port side of the GA capital ships. It took him a moment to recognize the source of the distraction. Tool, whose stealth X carried fewer armaments but better sensors than the other vehicles of sword flight. Tool, whose job it was to detect Jason Solo's tracking device with those sensors. Tool had to be tracking Jason now, and Jason had to be at the point toward which Tool had directed Luke's attention. Luke felt and quickly attempted to quell a sense of excitement, even celebration. If Jason was out on some sort of joyride, perhaps observing the capital ship engagement from a safe distance, then the Jedi might be able to ignore several levels of Jason's defenses that they had prepared for. The other Jedi were to follow Luke in toward the Anakin Solo. He would initiate the Jedi battle meld, not used before then so that Jason would not be forewarned, and all Jedi present were to begin accomplishing their respective assignments. But with this new situation, Luke merely needed to give the others a sense in the Force of his new direction and begin heading toward the spot Tool had pointed out to him. As they all neared Jason, their own passive sensors, less sensitive than Tool's, would pick up the signal from the tracking device Saha had placed on Jason's cloak. When they were near enough, Luke would open fire on Jason's vehicle and simultaneously initiate the battle meld. No additional communication was necessary. With the faintest of follow-me nudges to his comrades through the Force, Luke banked toward the distant target. Each of the three masters had a Jedi Knight as his wingmate, and Luke's was Sonola. Because she was the youngest Jedi Knight on this mission, she was paired with the most experienced master, which bothered Luke neither intellectually nor emotionally, except that he was reminded, approximately 3 times per second, that it should have been Mara's Stealth X pacing his own. A red target blip appeared on Luke's sensor board, identified as the signal from Jason's tracer. Luke eased off his thruster and coasted the last few kilometers, open to the Force, but not expressing himself through it. The white crosshairs representing his stealth X neared the target zone. Patient, Luke waited for the other Jedi to arrive. He could feel them,
faintly, nearing his location. It was time. Luke reached out for the other Jedi and felt his awareness merge with theirs, combining into the battle meld that made them so effective in group missions. Simultaneously, not bothering to work with targeting computers, blips, and brackets, he swung his snub fighter's nose a trifle to starboard, located his target by feel, and fired. Four lances of red light leapt from his Stealth X and converged on a distant point in space. Kydus felt the change a moment before he understood what it meant. One instant, he was floating in space with a crying little girl, distraught because he could not charm or coax away her tears. The next, he was expectant, hopeful, ready for a fight. They weren't his emotions. He had been enveloped by a Jedi battle meld. Even Alana felt it. Her head came up, her distress momentarily forgotten. With a curse he had not intended to utter in front of his daughter, Kydus grabbed the blur's control yoke and hit the thrusters. Not fast enough. The blur spun from the impact, then the thrusters kicked in, and he was hurtling away from that spot in space, executing one more tumble before he could gain complete control over his prototype TIE. He could begin to make out the identity of his ambushers now. Luke, the Shining Presence, Kip Duren, Corrin Horn, two or three others he didn't know well enough to recognize. Three masters this time. They'd learned their lesson at the Senate building when he'd finished off Kyle Katarn. He felt his enemies seeking him, felt them turning after him. He made himself smaller in the Force, reducing his presence to nothingness. He would give them nothing to work with. Lasers erupted behind him, missing by meters. He veered to starboard. The laser burst tracked his movement, clipping his port solar array wing before the burst ended. Kydus growled. They were homing in on Alana's Force presence. They had to be. His anger grew, consuming him, casting everything he saw within the cockpit, every star outside the viewport, in a haze of redness. So great it was that he could no longer contain his presence in the Force. His anger flowed through him, through Alana, through his pursuers, through everything in tune with him or the Force. The Love Commander waited, clamped by magnetic landing gear to the stern of the Anakin Solo, Han and Jaina staying alert for an opportunity to launch when the ship's gunners were likely to be distracted. The opportunity had not yet come. Leia, seated in the captain's chair, grew more restless, and then was hit by a wave of hatred. Redness and heat swamped her. Hatred for the Jedi, hatred for Luke, for the Confederation, for lasers and explosives and chaos. In the starboard seat ahead of her, she saw Jaina jerk, but her daughter was less affected than she had been.
"Sweetheart? Leia, what's wrong?"
In an instant, Han was by her side, gripping her flailing hand, helpless concern on his face.
"It's Jason. He's out there."
She gestured to starboard, well away from the Anakin Solo.
I don't know. I've never felt him like this."
Han's expression shifted from concern to grim determination.
"All right, we're going now. Turbo lasers or no turbo lasers. Time to prove that I can fly a sand bucket through an ion storm."
Luke felt the wave of hatred flow through him. It was so strong it felt like a kick in the gut, and he wondered for an instant if Jason had perfected some new Force attack. But no, the undercurrent was of frustration, helplessness, even fear. It was no attack. It was like a man in his last seconds of life, recognizing that fact. And Luke did not hate. He fired again, his laser cannons chipping away at the top of Jason's fuselage as his target. Through brilliant evasive flying, he kept his attacks from striking a more vital portion of the starfighter. Luke remained calm, reactive, ready to defend, ready to kill. He felt the other two Stealth X wing pairs approach his position. Soon, they would be in firing range. Soon, this would be over.
"Shields, then!"
Kydus disengaged the electronic countermeasures and activated his shields. Since he could not evade detection by his enemies, he would have to elude them for a while. Nor was there any need to maintain calm silence.
"Solo to Anakin Solo! Am under starfighter attack!
Get me some starfighter support here now. Bring the Anakin Solo as well.
Taboot's smooth, controlled voice answered him.
At once, sir.
Kytus heeled over to commence a sprint back to the capital ship formation, but he could feel Kip and Corrin vector to place themselves in his path, while Luke remained close behind. Juking and jinking, his own skills and force insights making him an unpredictable target, he moved away from the Alliance formation. He became lost in time, lost in his rage, existing in the moment. Then, there was intrusion. More presences. Kip and Corrin were suddenly farther away, reducing the number of inbound attacks. Kytus hazarded a glance at his sensor board. It showed a changed battlefield. He was now far away from the Alliance formation. In fact, it no longer was an Alliance formation. The Alliance and Corellian capital ships had merged into a single formation. Some distance away, a red blip representing an enemy the size of a small transport was inbound. Its transceiver signal showed it to be the Love Commander. Beyond that, the Anakin Solo was also inbound. Kytus nodded. He returned his attention to his flying. A moment's distraction now would kill him, but the end of this engagement was in sight. The Anakin Solo would arrive, its turbo lasers and ion cannons would chase the Jedi away, and he could return to safety. Luke stayed on Jason's tail, but the situation was worsening. Sonola T had dropped back to engage the enemy X-Wings and Aleph, but if their pilots were good, she couldn't hold them. And without the other two masters to help herd him, Jason would be able to turn back to the Anakin Solo. Luke had to finish this fight now. He opened himself further to the Force, hoping that it would give him insight, not just into where Jason was, but also where he intended to be in the next second. Jason was not concealing himself in the Force now. He was with a little girl. Luke started. He took his thumb off the laser trigger and probed again. There was, in fact, a little girl in the cockpit with Jason. Her presence had been washed out by the hatred Jason was pouring into the Force. But now Jason was calming, and the little girl's distress made her a brighter presence. Luke's stealth X shook. A quad laser blast from the pursuing Aleph had grazed him during his moment of surprise. Kill Jason? Kill an innocent? Luke veered away from his target and sent a nonverbal command for the other Jedi to form up on him. He felt their surprise and distress, but he made his intent stronger, insistent. The stealth X's veered away toward empty space. Kytus sagged as he gave way to exhaustion. He kept one hand on his control yoke, guiding the blur back toward the Anakin Solo, and used the other to hold Alana to him. She looked up at him, red-eyed, her tears unabated, hiccuping in her distress.
Colonel Solo to Starfighter Escort. Who's piloting the Twi?
A woman's voice came back immediately.
Dancer One, sir.
I mean your name.
Yes, sir. Lieutenant Sile Antilli, sir. Off Blue Diver.
Kytus grimaced. He'd been helped by the oldest daughter of an enemy, yet another traitor to the Alliance. Still, he had always promised to reward loyalty and merit, and moments ago, he had decided to do just that for the Aleph pilot.
It's Captain Antilles now.
Ahead of him, space far in the distance behind the Anakin Solo, back in the vicinity of the capital ships, was suddenly transfixed by a column of light, kilometers wide, that twisted and writhed like something alive. Space curled and wrenched, as though a vengeful child were playing with the controls of a monitor, stretching and distorting everything in the middle third of the screen. Kytus saw ships, silhouetted